My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight. Glad to be in Auburn. I like Auburn. I don't want to talk very interesting. I don't want to take your mind off the basket as it goes around. I'm glad to be here for your unity. I like unity days. I've been to several of them up here. First one I went to was in San Jose a few years ago, and Chuck C. was the evening speaker, and Jack Brennan was the noon speaker, and I was the middle of the afternoon speaker. Jack Brennan is really the bread of AA in San Francisco, and Chuck C. was the kind of the bread of AA in Los Angeles. So they put me as a ham in the middle to make a sandwich, I guess. But tonight it's a privilege to be here. You've had two very fine speakers, Patty and Linda. And I don't know if you're familiar with how carnivals work. My misspent youth, I spent a little time in a carnival. And you see these sideshows, they seem to be just extemporaneous, but they're really... they follow a well-charted pattern. They start off, they have these mooches on the midway. That's what you're known as. The only other place I know that people are known as mooches are on used car lots. You know, stuff this mooch in a sled and get him out of here. Here. But these mooches are on the midway milling around, and they want to get... they want to get a tip. A group of people is called a tip. So they get a talker out there. And he starts talking. Hey, hey, hey! And he has the pretty girls come out and dance or whatever they do, exotic things, and get all these mooches to go up there. Oh. Look at that, Lamar. I believe she would. And then... then they something called turning the tip. That's when they get a guy out there to quick capture their enthusiasm and get them to buy the tickets to get in there to see the show. It really isn't as good as the platform show. But that's called turning the tip. And then they get in, they see the show, then they want to hang around. So they send in another guy, and he does what is known as the blow off. He gets the mooches back out on the midway, so get another group of mooches in. So you've had a very good talker this morning in Patty, and a good show this afternoon in Linda. Now I'm going to blow you off. I'm going to get you mooches out of here, or at least dancing. But this is a nice day to have Unity Day. Unfortunately, I couldn't be here earlier. I don't know if your speakers mentioned it or not. But as most of you know, this is the last day of the 55th year of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 54th year, I should say. The last day. Tonight at midnight, AA will turn 55 years old. And those of you who are here dancing at that time, if you can just stop groping for a minute and... sing happy birthday. We old folks will be home in bed. But it's a great moment when you stop and think that 55 years seems like a long time, but it really isn't a long time when you stop and figure that people have been trying to find an answer for alcoholism for 5,000 years in recorded history. And you and I just happen to have been, by a stroke of fate, born into the one little window of time where there's a place to go for people like you and me. All the people before us never had a place to go, no matter how sincere they were. They've been fighting this problem. People thought they were some generation, they thought they were insane, put them in insane asylums. Sometimes they thought they were possessed by the devil and burned them alive. They've done a lot of terrible things. And you and I, through no fault of our own, through no virtue of our own, are sitting here tonight at the only time in the world's history where there's a place for people like you and me to go. And since AA, unfortunately, is made up of human beings, very few of us come and sit here suffused with gratitude and say, just think, I'm here at the very moment there's an answer to alcoholism. Instead, newcomers say, you mean there's some more of this ship tomorrow? And unfortunately, that's the problem we have to overcome in each other. AA only has two problems. It's made up of human beings and it's made up of alcoholics. And if it weren't for that, this would be a great place, but it is. And we share a lot of things. We all are here for various reasons. We come here under the lash. We like to think that other people maybe come here because they see there's a need for something to be done. But most people come here under the lash. A real saying goes, hardly anybody ever gets up in the morning and walks in through the French doors into the rose garden. God, what a lovely day. I think I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. We come here beaten and tired and hurt and lashed. And knowing one thing, that I hope they could help me, but unfortunately, my case truly is different. And that's kind of funny, except when you get to the point where you remember, the race is whether we can overcome that feeling in time for you to stay alive. Because that's what kills people in Alcoholics Anonymous and all alcoholics. And alcoholics who die from acute alcoholism die convinced of one thing, but I am not really an alcoholic. And they all have special reasons, and you all have your special reasons, and I have mine. And if we live to be 100 years old, none of us will ever eradicate the feeling deep within us that my case truly is different. But what we can do here is find ways to reduce it to just a feeling so it is no longer an obsession. Because when it becomes an obsession, then people die from it. Every day when I go to work, I have to step over people dying from alcoholism to get into my office. And you would think that there'd be some answer for them. You know, some people say, well, God doesn't love them. He singled you out. I don't believe that. I don't believe God singles anybody out. I think God wants everybody to do well. The question is, why are some people doing well and why aren't? Why aren't they? Why is it that some people in this room will stay sober and do well till they die, and some people in this room are going to die drunk and die bad? And I'm not saying it's going to be you, it might be me, because it's happened to a lot of people who've been sober a long time when they get carried away with their... when they slide back into that terrible obsession that my case truly is different. So it all boils down to, somehow or other, people like you and me have to get together on a continuing basis to keep reminding each other of things we already know so that we can emotionally adjust ourselves to remembering why we are here. And it's very difficult to do because most of us have had backgrounds where once you know a subject, you should go on to a new subject. And here it is, what you know doesn't mean anything. You can know it all. In my experience, I've known people. I'll tell you, my sponsor who saved my life when I was in a difficult case, he saved my life, and he was 15 years sober, and he had me take actions, and he wouldn't put up with my crap, and I just idolized him. And the next year, he got mad over some imagined slight. And he stopped going to meetings, and a year after that, he was dead drunk and dying. And people said to me, Jesus, I hope this is going to make you drunk. I explained to him, no. It just proves what he said was right. He always told me, if you don't continue to do these things, you'll get drunk. And he stopped doing them, and he got drunk. So that proved what he said was true. But I don't want to prove anything to my babies that way if it's all the same to you. I'd rather let them guess. But I know we have some new people here today. New guy got the book. You're a neat young man. Our hats are off to you. Maybe someday your hat will be off to us. What we have in common here to the new person, you may wonder what we have in common. This is a kind of unusual place. You wonder why you are here. Once you're here a few days or even a few weeks, or even in a few days, you will learn what seem to be the basic facts of Alcoholics Anonymous. They extend them out a little bit more, but there are certain things that everybody knows about AA. AA is the place where bad drinkers go to get sober. And then after they're sober, they return to God. And then after they return to God, they show their gratitude by helping others. And it's a nice thing, and it helps people with these drinking problems. And for people like me, that had no effect on me whatsoever, and I couldn't imagine what the hell was wrong with me. Because when I came to AA a long time ago, I never felt I belonged here. And then the next time I came, I didn't feel I belonged here. And the next time I came, I didn't feel I belonged here because of one thing. Deep in my heart, I always knew that there was something different about me. My life, my problems are too complex to be overcome by stopping drinking. That seems to help some people, but it doesn't help me. I've always battled my emotions. I've always battled these feelings I've had. It always seems to be my feelings are too intense. And it seems to me I'm too sensitive to things. I can pick up on things that other people can't pick up on. And I know when I'm being rejected. And I know when people are screwing me around. And I feel things too intensely. And I want things to be right. And other people just seem to go through life. But I have feelings, strong feelings. And by God, they were uncomfortable. When I was a kid, when I was a young man, I was always fighting some emotions and grinding inside. So I tried a lot of therapies. I went into psychoanalysis. A lot of people in AA say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. It was wonderful for me. I made breakthroughs that bring tears down your cheeks. I discovered I'd been repressed as a child. I didn't know that when I found out it really pissed me off. I found out I'd been religiously scarred. I didn't know that. I was raised in a very strict church, but it was a fair one. As far as I could tell, the Norwegian Lutheran Church only ever had two rules. Don't ever do anything bad, and don't hang around with Catholics. I turned out bad and married a Catholic, but you know, you can't blame the church for that. That's not their fault. It wasn't until years later in psychoanalysis I discovered that they had scarred me. You know, I've said this many times, but I never can say it too often. I don't know if most of you have never heard of the Norwegian Lutheran Church. We all think a strict church is the Catholic Church. In Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where I grew up, if you were a Norwegian Lutheran and you couldn't make it, and you were too weak, and too fallible and too sinful, you could always become a Catholic. That was for quitters who just had to play bingo. There's an old saying, I don't know if it's true or not, but it sounds true. Norwegian Lutherans, even if they're married for 30 years, would never make love standing up. Just in the fear that some passerby might think they were dancing. It's a strict church. And I discovered when I was grown up that they had repressed me and left psychological scars. I discovered all sorts of things. I discovered I'd been deprived as a child. I didn't know that. I was raised in a depression. Didn't even know it was a depression. So I went to psychoanalysis. How it all started one day. Opened a whole Pandora's box of self-pity when the guy said, you mean to say, Mr. Muslim, at this time in 1935, you didn't have a bicycle? And I said, no. But I got thinking about it on the way home. I began to remember I never had anything. for about 2 months after that, every time I ran, I really throw myself into a gut-wrenching, warming depression. You know, people like us say, oh, I don't want any depressions. We all have to have a little depression now and then just to clean up a little bit. It's like carrying your own portable cross. You just set it up wherever you are. And don't forgive them, Father. They know what they do. But every time I wanted to get one of those, all I had to do was visualize in my mind's eye a little apple-cheeked, tousled-haired, blue-eyed, brave little kid standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles. Don't worry about me. I'll go into psychoanalysis. Took me almost 2 months to remember that in 1935, nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle. One kid finally got one. We thought he was a freak. We beat him up and broke his bicycle. But the one thing that psychoanalysis does for people like me, it really waters and irrigates your paranoia. You just know you've been screwed and self-pity, and it gives you a lot of hooks. That's one of the sad things, it all seemed to me, about many of the therapies where you, based on whose fault it is, the way you're the way you are. And that is, you wind up with a lot of hooks, and you can prove that it's their fault, this, and it's their fault I have this feeling, and their fault. And since I've got them laid off, I don't have to do anything about them. And I have to live with them. That's one of the sad things. And I'm not judging nor attacking. But I'm just saying, in my experience, what I have seen, the big problem in much of ACA is that they sit immersed in resentment towards their parents, and they never get any better. I've never seen anyone leave an ACA meeting smiling. And you'll see people leaving AA meetings smiling. Remember, I talked to Dr. Bob's son. His name is Robert Bob Smith. He's in his 70s now. I talked to him once. I said, God, you're the oldest living adult child of an alcoholic in the world. Your father was the founder. Do you belong to ACA? And he said, no. He said, I refuse to be frozen into the posture of a resentful teenager. And I said, well, that's certainly a fine attitude to take, I said. Well, I didn't actually say it. I said, good, but I didn't really... But I'm not putting anything down. It's just that people like me, I find reasons for why I feel bad. Later on, I got into metaphysics, and I was getting weirder. And I had to go to the whip, you know. Now, there are people today who go to metaphysics, but it isn't the same. Today, metaphysics is kind of cheap. So many little people have been in it. In my day, just the thinkers and the seekers were there. We sought the oneness of the infinite self. I don't like to gloat, but at one time, I hate to go to anywhere where it's going to be 110 all summer and gloat. But sometimes I walk by that ocean and I just shiver. I say, Jesus, only about 78. Sure. But at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And they don't like truth in Texas, it turned out. It makes them upset. They finally got so jealous they put me in the insane asylum. Not for drinking. I didn't sink to that. This was just for being crazy. I've read books. I've done a lot of things. Because my whole lifetime has been spent on two facets. The first and major one, and I'm sure that many of you in this room are in it right now, because it's a very natural search to find out, why do I have these damn feelings? Why has my life turned out this way? What's the reason for it? And I'll tell you, I've spent thousands of dollars and years of my life in that search, and sure there are people in this room who have done it and will continue to do it. I'm not putting it down at all. It's a very natural thing. But I want to tell you only one negative about it. The positive is you can find out in several different therapies reasons for the feelings and your life's directions. And they are different, but they all seem kind of valid. The negative thing is they don't help. You wind up knowing why. You wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. That's what you wind up. Well, I feel crappy, but I can explain why. Here's what. The only possible use that I ever found that information, late at night in a bar, some guy might say, "Hey, what the hell's wrong with you?" And then you can tell him, "Well, I..." Turns out they really don't want to hear it. That's just a figure of speech. "Ah, shut up, folks." The greatest help I ever had in my life is one that I never paid much attention to except for its therapeutic. When I was a boy, 15 years old, on the deck of a ship in Pearl Harbor early in the Second World War, a runaway from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, going and got to kill Japs. And some grown-up men made me take a drink of whiskey that I didn't want to take, but I wanted anything, given anything to have them accept me. So I drank some whiskey, and they made me throw up. And they laughed at me, which made me feel worse. Later, I tried to drink some more, when nobody was looking, and I threw it up. When I drank some more, when nobody was looking, I threw it up. And finally, one day, I remember I held some down, and it was terrible. But all of a sudden, something kicked in, and I didn't know something unusual. It turned out that my body was almost instantly, unnaturally affected by alcohol. I had no idea it was an unnatural affection. And years later, I died once, was brought back to life, and almost died again, and I still didn't know. But it turns out that's what makes an alcoholic. Some people, it hits you the first drink you hold down. Some people drink for 20 years before it happens. Some people drink for 30 years before it happens. But most people get it right away or in the first 10 years or so. But alcohol, I discovered on that ship, made me feel the way those men looked, if only briefly. And that was a great thing. I never found anything like it. To this day, I have never found anything that works as surely to make me feel good as alcohol. That's a terrible thing to say in an AA meeting. You know, it hurts me when I hear speakers get up and say, "That damn alcohol! It almost was poison! It's just terrible!" It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of mine. You know. "Hey, wait a minute. She may be a pig now, but she didn't used to be." Alcohol had the facility of making me feel good. And it was great. But it did something even more than that. As I began, I didn't become a terrible old drunk. I was only a kid. I tried to learn to drink it over the years and try to handle it. And I realized it was kind of explosive, but it did some wonderful things. It allowed me to do things and be things that I could not be by myself. It enabled me to be expansive. I've always been, most of my life, those years, shy, introverted, feeling inadequate. And when I had some alcohol, it made me feel expansive, and I could talk and laugh. And I thought I was making smart remarks, clever remarks. It just made me feel confident. When my kids were little, I always felt I was a much better father when I drank than when I was sober. When I was sober, I was such a grouchy old son of a bitch, but when I had a few drinks, I was just like the father I wish I'd have had, just... A few years ago, now I've lost my place, so I'll have to start over. My name is Clancy, and it's fun that I've... A few years ago, at the beginning, before there was an ACA, but they were just the first beginning of the movement of the adult children of alcoholics,
Nightline did a program on it
a number of years ago.
And they, I don't know how they got my name, but they interviewed our family. My oldest daughter was at that time teaching at the University of New Mexico, and she was home with her children at Christmas. They sent a camera crew out from New York, and they interviewed her. They interviewed me about what it feels like to have your father being an alcoholic and your daughter being a non-alcoholic. And I guess they interviewed a bunch of people, and it's supposed to air the following Monday. And I couldn't wait. I mean, I didn't care to see myself on television, but I wanted to see how my daughter looked. And I don't like to... AA has no opinion on foreign relations or politics, but that goddamn Gaddafi did something so bad that Saturday they preempted our program with it. I almost sent a death squad over to get him, that old fool. About 6 months later, I was sitting in Madison, Wisconsin University one night. My wife called me. She said, "Oh, that program's on tonight. It's going to be on tonight. They just called from New York." So I stayed up. I watched it. And God, what a dreary program. A bunch of grown-up children whining. I probably would have been president, but my parents' alcoholism held me back. It was terrible. I never been able to do a thing. And these parents get on one after other, including me. "Oh, I'm just so sorry. I ruined my child's life. It's just terrible." Whip, you don't need them. It's enough to gag a maggot. Just on and on. And the program ended. And they hadn't had my daughter. They didn't have my daughter's interview on. And I was shocked. And I quick called her in Albuquerque. I said, "Mary, they didn't put you on there. You were watching the show." She said, "She's mother called me." I said, "They didn't have you on the show." She said, "I didn't think they would." I said, "Well, why is that?" She said, "Didn't you hear what they were talking about? Did you hear what I said?" I said, "You were always much more pleasant when you drank. It's when you were sober it was so terrible." And sometimes I drank too much, and especially when I was a young man, it enabled me to go have fun that I could never have had as a Norwegian Lutheran introverted inadequate puke. I'll tell you, there's something ennobling about being in a bar room late at night and having somebody say something like, "Let's go to Mexico!" And be with real people who say, "Yeah! Yeah!" And not be with those wussies who say, "Why?" "It's so late. What'll I tell Phyllis?" "Tell her to keep you home, you wimp." I love that. I just love it. And it gave me a lot of balance in my life because I'm introverted. This gave me a little extroverted to go with it. A few months ago, 3 or 4 months ago, I've been talking a little bit about this lady, but I'll talk about it one more time. 3 or 4 months ago, I saw a movie again on television at Christmas time. But whenever it's on, about once a year, I try to see it because it always reminds me one of the great memories of my experience with alcohol. Not in the way you would think. When I tell you the name of the movie, you say, "Oh, I know," but not the way you think. But this old movie was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And it's the real version with Spencer Tracy and great cast, not the second-rate cast we have. And I don't know, maybe you've seen, most of you have seen, know the plot anyway. Dr. Jekyll is just a wonderful, good, perfect man. And he just has a little interest. I wonder what it would be like to be evil once in a while. He's always mixing up these hideous potions to test, and finally he gets the right formula together, and pow, he turns into total evil. There's a lesson to be learned from that. Never drink anything that smokes. In that movie, you become evil. In another movie, you become a werewolf. If it's smoking, let that sandwich go, I'll tell you. But he becomes evil. And what he does, he has this hooker across town, played by Ingrid Bergman, and he goes over there, Mr. hide and beats the hell out of her. She's yumping, yimini. Shut up, you know. Gets it out of her system, comes back, has a little drink. Back to Dr. Jekyll. Next case, please. And then a few days later, when he feels a little restless, irritable perhaps, over across town with Ingrid Bergman. Oh, Jesus Christ, shut up, you know. He comes back and takes. This goes on for quite a while. He has a good time. Ingrid's getting a little punchy. Yeah. Requiem for a welterweight. So finally, but he's had enough of this. He's going to go straight now. He's proved his case. He's had his fun. Now he's going to announce his engagement to his pure fiancée. So he locks up all of his chemicals, walks over to her house through the park, whistling, and his lovely fiancée, this virgin, in a triumph of casting played by Lana Turner. This was just shortly before she stabbed Johnny Stompanato. And he's going over there to announce his engagement. She lives with her father, played by Donald Crisp. That's one of the ways you know you're getting older in the world. When I can't remember who I was Monday, but I remember Donald Crisp from 1940. Have I been here before? Hello. And here now starts the problem. He's walking over there. No drinking that stuff now. But he didn't mean to this time. But he goes over. Instead of being at the engagement party, there he is over at Ingrid's again. Shut up, you know. He just barely gets back and drinks his stuff to get back. From then on, his life was hell. Because when it got so he didn't mean to, it really was brutal. And finally, the time came, as they always do in those movies, where they hung him, Mr. Hyde, down, and they killed him. And as they always did in those movies, as he lay on the ground dead, through a series of dissolves, he turned into Dr. Jekyll again. And, oh, it is better that some things that men do not know. Ooh. Yeah. So touchy, I don't know if I can go on. But in a real sense, that's what I identify with alcohol. I loved alcohol, and I loved what it did for me, and it gave me a chance to get out and do things I couldn't do. I never had Ingrid Bergman. I had her grandmother twice, I think. Something to be said for maturity. But, just great. Fun. Fun. Ha, ha, ha. Instead of being that wimp, wussy, frightened guy I was most of the time, I could go do something, have fun, come back on Monday, be hungover and sick, which is kind of a badge by itself. Guys say, boy, you really had a good one this weekend, huh? Yes, I did. And the only problem came was when finally, now my kids were coming and I wanted to change it. No more. Now I'm going to become mature and concentrate my career and give them something to think about and to live with. And then began the unfortunate and tragic end to everything I believe, hope for. Because I started going over when I didn't mean to. Like finding yourself in a bar at 11 o'clock at night, thinking, oh, Christ, what am I doing here? I was supposed to be at my daughter's birthday party at 6 o'clock. I only stopped for a drink. God damn it. Or later you find yourself another night in some fight in some sleazy bar at midnight. Think, oh, my God. I was going to take my son to the ball game tonight. What in the hell? How did this... Or some other time later on, or you're in jail at night, and think, oh, Christ, how could this be? I'm supposed to have a big meeting in my company at 8 o'clock. I'll never even be bailed out till 9. Shit, what do I tell them? Or the great culmination in my life, the day my father came out of my jail cell, which he never did. Said, you have a good time while you're drunk last night, Clancy? I said, no, Dad, I didn't mean to. I swear to God, I didn't mean to. I never meant to do this. It's going to be all different. He says, I hope you had a good time, because while you're out drunk, your little boy died, and we couldn't find you, you drunken thing. I hope I never see you again. And I'll tell you, I almost went crazy that morning. I would have given my life to keep that from happening. And all you can cry out is, I didn't mean to. For God's sakes, I didn't want to. And I understand just exactly how Dr. Jekyll feels walking through the park. Instead of being over there, he's over here again. Of course, the question would be, if it's doing this to you, why don't you should stop drinking? And that came to mind early on. But there are two things that negate that. One, it doesn't happen every time you drink. For me, there's a lot of times I drank and didn't get in fights and didn't go to jail and didn't have trouble. I look back at my life, says, oh, for years I was playing some kind of alcoholic roulette, just getting some clicks and some bangs and wondering why the hell the bangs were coming at the wrong time. As the years go by, there are more bangs and less clicks. But even so, okay, even though it doesn't happen much, I'm going to stop drinking entirely. In fact, I was sent to my first AA meeting. A lot of people thought I had a drinking problem. And I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. And AA was only 14 years old at that time. I didn't think that. I just said, I've been here forever, like it must be new people tonight. And I was 22. Now, 22 doesn't sound very young today, but at that time, there was nobody within 15 or 20 years of me that anybody had ever heard of. And they thought I was a freak, and I thought they were a freak. And they said those things. I learned those things in three meetings, the things I told you. Go to AA and stop drinking. Eventually turn your back, return to God, and show your gratitude, help others. And I tried that for a little while, but that isn't my problem. My problem is not drinking. My problem are the emotions come when I am sober and I have nothing to help me overcome them. So then I started another pattern that stayed with me for years. Something that I'm sure most of the people in this room... I'll tell you what. To this the new people tonight, you may wonder what you have in common with all these people. Certainly not your age, not your color, not your size, not your weight, not how much you drank, not what you drank, not where you drank it, not what happened to you. None of these things. There's nothing you have in common. I'll tell you one little thing you have in common, however, if you be an alcoholic of our type, and this thing you will have in common is that all of us at one time or another have been put into a situation where we have voluntarily, whether we knew it or not, embraced and hung on to the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And the book says, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Why in Christ would we all grab onto that illusion? I'll tell you why. Because that's what happens when alcohol begins to be a problem and you discover that staying sober is terribly painful. So you can't stay sober and you can't drink, so you must find ways. And people like us try to find those ways. And it says in the book, occasional brief recoveries followed always by still worse relapse. And it gives a whole paragraph of things people like us do. Changing from scotch to brandy, or drinking beer only, or reading spiritual literature, or taking physical exercise, or drinking only at home, or never drinking at home, or taking a trip, or not taking a trip, or swearing off, or taking vows. It says the last words in that paragraph say, we could increase the list ad infinitum, which means forever. And there isn't anyone in this room who hasn't done those things and said, maybe this is what. This is what. Because there's one thing that's easy to learn. My problem really isn't alcohol. It looks like it is to people, and well-meaning people who want to help me think it is, but I'm the only one who knows it isn't. Sometimes I just want to shout at them. You think my problem is alcohol? Why don't you come to my house some morning at 2 in the morning when I'm on the wagon and sober and watch, stare in my bedroom in the dark and watch me lie in bed with my eyes wide open and my head going 100 miles an hour and my gut churning and wondering what the hell is wrong with the world and me and why these kids aren't better and why my job isn't better and what they're doing to me. You watch me lie there for an hour and you won't think my problem is alcohol. You may understand why I drink. I drink to ease that off. And it does. But sometimes I drink too much. And I got to do something about that because people are on me like for that. And starts that pattern of attempting to find a way to drink so I don't feel terrible, but not drink so much that I don't feel terrible. It's a thin line, boy. And everybody in this room has been in it who's an alcoholic. And go back to AA. That's why I started going to therapies, psychoanalysis, metaphysics, and read books. From time to time, I'd go back to AA. I didn't even think it would help anymore, but AA wasn't very well known then, and you could fool an employer, say, I'm going back to AA, and he'd say, oh, I understand that does wonderful work. At least it gives you elbow room. But it's always the same old stuff. It's great for drinkers. Stop drinking, return to God, and show your gratitude to help others. And pretty soon you just feel like a fox in a forest, fire boy. There's flames all around you. There's no way to go, and nobody can tell you. And they all think they got an answer for you, and none of them know a goddamn thing about how you feel. I hope you all see that balloon going by. The washroom is in there. But it got so bad one time when I was trying to stay sober for my wife that I just got in the garage and turned the motor in my car and went to sleep and died. The guy found me dead in the car. He put me in the insane asylum for that. But that's how I get. There's got to be a way. And many years later, I found myself, everything gone. Found myself being thrown out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles. I tried to explain to the guy, I'm not a bum. I just had my front teeth kicked out. I must have looked like a bum. But I said, I'm not a bum. Jesus, 3 years ago, I directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. Somebody ought to take that home, use it for safe sex. Can I explain that I'm not a bum? Ads that I wrote, some other guys for the Borden Company, L.C. Nelmer ads, some of you old people read them, were still running in magazines, and here I was. And I'd had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know, you just... And I had no front teeth, so I couldn't really punch out those consonants the way I wanted to. That's the first time in 31 years. Usually they just sit during the meetings trying to find out new reasons why their tapes sound funny. Well, I think the metal was on the fodder as there is. I stood that sidewalk outside of the Skid Row Mission dying, and I'll tell you, if a man would have come along and said, your life depends on the correct answer to this question. Are you an alcoholic? I said, no, I'm not, and I wish to hell I was. I wish I was! But problems are a little more complex than answers in AA, unfortunately. One morning I walked 71 blocks in an AA club called the 60 Year Club, and I lurked around there and I hated it, and they did the same thing then as they do now. I said, get a sponsor, and I got a sponsor, and he was a crazed dictator, old fool. I'd seen him in movies. He was a character actor. He always played kindly, loving roles, and he was just a crazy dictator. I'll try to explain to him why some of these actions didn't apply to me. I don't want to hear that shit. You live in an abandoned car. Shut up. What's that got to do with anything? He would embarrass me. He made me take... He says, I don't care what you believe, kid. You just do what I tell you. Will you do that? I said, all right. I had nothing else I was thinking about doing, so I tried to stay out of his sight, because he would, most embarrassing, humiliating, he would have me do things in the middle of crowds. He'd holler at me. Do you know what it's like to be insecure and be hollered at by... When you're not even an alcoholic and you're in an AA meeting being hollered at. What saved my life, I took some actions, I hated him over a period of time, he made me do things, I hated him. Just one day, I had one of the greatest breakthroughs in the history of mankind. If I'd have been a Greek, I'd have said, Eureka! Or whatever the hell that guy was that did that. But one day, he gave me another piece of crap in the middle of a meeting. Go and apologize to that woman. Why, said I? Because you call her a bitch. Well, she is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she was right. Go and apologize. That's about some... I'm not going to apologize. And it suddenly struck me, a wave, if you're new, write this down. I didn't have to believe it or mean it. I just had to do it. I went over there and I said, sorry. Bitch. From then on, I fooled that old man so often and all. He'd have me do stupid things. I'd say, okay. And I'd go do them. Go to that meeting. Okay. I think, I'm outsmarting you, you old bastard. I don't even want to do it. I fooled him so often, I started to get better. That's a great lesson to learn. And little by little, I got better. Had jobs, got fired off. I had a terrible early sobriety because I had a bad attitude with employers, especially. I mean, you know, got fired as a dishwasher when I was 6 months sober. And it's kind of hard to defend it tonight, but at that time, it was clear. I was working in this place. And it seemed to me the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. So I began to deduce, these pukes are getting dishes from other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. So I just didn't do their dishes. I miscounted. Cost me my job. I lasted till noon on a moving job one time. I said, hey, you, without the teeth, you bumped my arm. That was one of the days I was just had been thinking, I direct you to Grand Opera. I'm a talented man. They're treating me like an ignorant piece of crap. And now this guy screams at me that I bumped his goddamn lamp. I said, no, you're mistaken, sir. I broke your goddamn lamp. You can't push creative people. But I survived and finally held a job wrapping packages little by little. And things got a little bit better. But I want to tell you what happened to me most importantly in the first months and years of my sobriety that changed my life. And I hope if you listen, if you are weak and heavy laden tonight, or if you're new, you might listen because it might help you. You might think, how did I overcome this thing in AA? Because we all know what AA is. It's a place where you go and get sober, turn to God, show gratitude by helping others. I'm glad that I survived long enough to discover something very, very important about those things. I think recently I mentioned this somewhere else, but I'll mention it one more time. I'm going to give you some information that you wouldn't have heard in another meeting in America tonight. And you're lucky to be here, because I'm just going to give you an analogy that's going to just stagger you. Look at that man, he's staggering out already. Just in anticipation. I'm going to tell you how they train elephants. True story. Take baby elephants, put heavy chains on their legs, put them to a big tree, and then let them pull. And they pull, and they just tear their legs to shreds. They pull and fight and fight and fight and fight and fight. And one day, they just give up. They realize they cannot pull that chain or that tree. And from then on, that elephant is tame in that area. If you ever go by a carnival or a circus, you notice where they have elephants lined up. They're not in big chains. They have small chains that put a little peg in the ground. Because the elephants start to move. As soon as they feel the pressure of the chain, they know they can't move that tree, although there's no tree there anymore. They never run away. Elephants will stay and be burned up in a fire because they know they can't pull that chain out, although they could pull it out just like that. And people like me, and I presume like some of you, have beliefs that act as just exactly those kind of chains. We die convinced of things because we're not willing to understand. We could pull those out of the ground just like that. And the things I've told you about Alcoholics Anonymous are those chains for me. I had to come to understand that AA is not a place to go and get sober, that you never return to God, that you never show your gratitude by helping others. That's not the point of AA in any way. If I'd have kept believing those things, I would be dead tonight. But of course you might say, oh, what the hell does that mean? Of course everybody knows AA's point of AA is going to place and getting sober. False. No one has ever needed AA to get sober, nor ever will. You don't even need treatment centers to get sober. You don't even need anything to get sober. I'll tell you an interesting thing about the human body. The human body fights for survival. No human body will stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in the laboratory. One of the rottenest parts about being a drinker, you keep sobering up. Your body fights to sober up again and again and again. And most of us have watched that in a very common way. When your body, for example, is highly toxified, it will set up a series of involuntary, physiologically conditioned reflexes to reduce toxicity by inducing a procedure called reverse peristalsis. Now, to most of us, that's known as puking. But that's all your body's doing unless you sober up. I'm sure there are not very many people in this room who haven't knelt in front of the old porcelain altar early in the morning and gazed into those shimmering waters and say your morning prayer.
Oh, God.
You hardly ever stop and think,
hey, I'm getting a free detox. This won't show up on the insurance.
Some mornings when you're sick enough, your body will detoxify you from both ends at once. That's good for your body, but bad for your nerves because you're called upon him to make a series of split-second decisions. and every answer must be correct. I'll tell you something. If getting sober was any help, there'd be no need. But alcoholics of our type find out that isn't the case. There may be alcoholics of a different type who getting sober helps. But I assume that's the people that schick hospitals help. That in 7 or 10 days they cure them of the, whatever problem they've had. If it's real bad, they may need 2 follow-up visits. You just want to say, you poor bastard! Bob Tobin, where are you? I need a Pepsi and be quick about it. Since I got the most sobriety in the room, that's how I got it, by getting other guys to do my dirty work for me. Oh, don't do any bother for me, Bob. But I'll tell you something. I'll tell you a thing that may bother your mind if you haven't heard it, know of it.
You can open it yourself.
Did you hear what he said? You can open it yourself. That's why God made newcomers. I don't know why I'm never invited back anywhere. I try to be nice. But seriously, very seriously, I want to tell you something that may boggle your mind. If you're new or heavy laden, if your problem is alcohol, you shouldn't be in AA. It has nothing to do with an alcohol problem. Doesn't that sound odd? I'll tell you this. If you're an alcoholic, your problem is not alcohol. If your problem is alcohol, you're not an alcoholic. How can that be?
Some kind of crazy talk?
Not at all. There are many differences between alcohol problems and alcoholism, but I can put it in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this strange, denigrating, destructive, eroding, mind-boggling, eventually lethal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking as such has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful that you cannot stand it. That's what makes alcoholism deadly, is that sobriety always becomes emotionally unbearable. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. Something else must be present. You must be one of the 5 or 6% of people, it's true in this generation, and true as far back as they could make records, who have one other thing. They must have an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Only 5% or 6% of people have it. What is this unnatural reaction, Uncle? Makes you drunk all the time? Nope. Makes you act crazy? Some people do. Some people don't. Can't handle it? Alcoholics in tests can handle a given amount of alcohol better than social drinkers in almost any kind of a test. Then what the hell is the special effect? Alcohol, the unnatural effect, it must have the power to almost instantly make everything seem all right. And it's hard to remember, it doesn't do that for most people. We just think it does it for everybody. It doesn't. As my sponsor pointed out to me, can't you get this through your head, you dumb little puke, he said, words to that effect. When they drink alcohol, it goes... When you drink alcohol, it goes... That's why you're here and they're not. You might think about that the next time you're wondering if you're really an alcoholic. Would you really like to live a life where when your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate are at your throat, you take a drink. Oh, God, give me a drink. And have it go. Blah, blah, blah. No more for me. I'm starting to feel it. If that's the way it does to you, you can drink it. Or do you drink for this reason? When your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate are ripping your throat, you take a drink. Oh, God! And it doesn't go, blah, blah, blah. It goes, boom! You with anyone, Granny? You want to fight, Copper? Take your job and shove it, Mr. Carlson. Later, you may wonder why you've said any of these things. But there's a momentary omnipotence. And there's nothing wrong with that, I'll tell you. We talk a lot about drinking as opposed to drug addiction. If you're an alcoholic, alcohol will make you feel better than drugs make addicts feel. I've been working with addicts for over a quarter of a century. Heroin gets you to a certain great euphoria, but you can't do it very long before you have to overdose to get there. The living curse of all heroin addicts, you keep trying to overdose to get back to where you were and you can't get there. Cocaine addicts makes it sound so romantic, sniffing on $100 bills. See these people way up there, intense speed reactions, euphoria, and then pretty soon the addiction comes, and pretty soon the paranoia and the difficulty, the terrible addiction, they can't get out of it. Alcoholics don't get way up there like that, and they don't get way down there like that. When alcohol is working, it puts you right in the middle with your holes full. It may not last, you may not be able to hold it, but God damn it, that edge is just wonderful. So you won't think wrong. If it does that for you, pretty soon you can't live without it, and you can't live in sobriety, and you can't live drinking. So coming to AA to get sober is not going to help you. You can sit in an AA meeting sober for a year, and at the end of that time, go out and commit suicide. Being sober is the vestibule of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what you do after you are sober that makes the difference. AA has nothing to do with sobriety, except to maintain it. Interesting, the seventh word of the 12 steps is alcohol, and it's never mentioned again. Alcohol is just something you give up when you get here. That's why over a period of time, you must begin to do something that nothing else in history's ever done. You must very slowly be able to acquire the things that alcohol does for you fast. Alcohol, little by little, has to alter my, or AA has to alter my perception of reality, to little by little change my relationship to my environment, to little by little begin to fill holes that alcohol did instantly, but is killing me. So don't ever think that, well, I'm sober. Our book talks about it expressly. It says being sober is not enough. It's enough at any given moment, but overall it's not enough. That's why people like us need sponsors. We need to go to meetings. And we must work over a period of time steps. Some of you may have come out of treatment facilities where you think you've worked the steps, because they give you the steps to do in the 20th or 25th day. You will take years to work these steps to depth. What they give you in the treatment center is just an exercise. You have no goddamn more business thinking you're sober after that than you do with flying. They do what they're supposed to do. They get you off booze and they give you hope. But out here in the world, alcoholics of our type need a long-term solution, and you won't find it on the memory of what you got in your 17th day in the treatment center. Now, when you're going to return to God, I couldn't do that. I told my sponsor that years ago. I said, I can't return to God. I mean, I'd like to, but I am hopelessly stained. I cannot return to God because there's nothing I can do that's going to change it. And he said, you don't have to return to God. I said, oh, I have to return to a higher power. Boy, that really fools a lot of people, I bet. Oh, He says, no, it doesn't mean that either, you little shit. He explained. He says, you got to start with this premise. In AA, you never return to anything. Our whole goal here is getting away from old, sick perceptions of reality. Those, in what I would say today, those chains that hold us. We got to get away from that. You never return to anything. Years ago, some of these old people who got sober in their 50s wrote, return to normal living. But they're not, people like us, going to return to that either, because there's no normal living to return to. What you got to remember is that alcohol has an unnatural reaction, and it changes everything. Just in passing, in case it comes up in your mind, you may wonder why there are people coming to AA at 50 and people coming to AA at 20, and they seem to have the same disease, and both of them, they couldn't go much further. And you hear old guys get up, you get up the podium, and they say things like, I drank for 35 years, and look accusingly at some little snot in the front row, as if to say, I drank longer than you've been alive, you little snot. And he doesn't know the little snot is there looking at him thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 30 years, you old son of a bitch. It turns out it isn't how long you drank, it's when it begins to have that effect, when you must have it to equalize the pressures in your emotions. I said, I can't return to God. He said, you don't have to return to God. You come to believe in things. All the way through AA, you come to change things. He said, can you believe in God? Come to believe in God? I said, no. He said, can you come to believe in AA? And I said, no. He said, do you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, yes. He said, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. Now, a lot of people told me later, they ridiculed me and said, you can't have a human being as your higher power, for Christ's sake. I'm going to tell you something. You can have anything that you want for your higher power, and you better have something you really believe in. Because it's easy to talk about God at the meetings and shuck him. But when it gets to be 2 o'clock in the morning, and you got to turn to what you really believe, if you've been shucking them, you're dead. You better have a sponsor you believe in or somebody out there you believe in. And I came to take actions. As I said, fool that old man. And I took actions and fooled him and got better. Pretty soon, AA looked different. And that became my higher power. And I kept taking actions. Over a period of time, I began to work with people, try to do something. And over a period of time, I came to believe in God. I would have bet my life that it would never happen. But that fierce Norwegian, vengeful Lutheran God, I came to believe in what guys were telling me. There's a loving God who means well for me, and it's up to me to get my head out of my butt and get it going. I can shake my fist, have it all day, but I got to change my dance. And I remember my first prayer I said, and I was afraid because I thought, God, what if God strikes me dead for all my sins when I'm saying this prayer? I just thanked him for keeping me sober. And I've not gone to bed or gotten up in the morning for over 30 years of praying earnestly to a God that I would have bet my life I never could believe in. Remember a few years ago sitting in the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, with my mother's little casket. And I was glad she died because she'd been so sick. I remember looking around these old, frightening Norwegian guys in this old church with the pictures on the wall and the big cross. I thought to myself, isn't that wonderful? Because I took actions years ago in AA, I've come to see that the God in this church is just as loving as it is in the meetings in California, even though some of these people here don't know it. It's a God means well for me. And it's a hard thing to remember because I want to blame him for everything. The gift of sobriety is that God will always get me sober. The gift of free will is that I've been given actions I can take to stay sober. And Monday morning when I walk into my office over dying bodies, I would give anything to help those people. But they have put off help till it's too late. They are immersed in the pattern of what my case is different. Nothing can help. And nothing can happen from the outside unless somebody opens the door from the inside. That's one of the saddest things in the world. I travel all over the world speaking. Last month and a half ago, I was in Berlin, speaking at the Wall, for Christ's sake, to a group of alcoholics, and Frankfurt. And I've been in London and Glasgow and Belfast and New Zealand and Mexico and Canada and all over hell. And I'm supposed to be a hotshot speaker. You would think I'd be able to help some guy I know and love who's dying in front of me. But I can't. Because when you're inside that wall, boy, if you don't open the door from the inside, there's nobody can get to you. That's why we always got to make sure we keep that door open a little bit. Because we got to do it ourselves. But you're not here to get sober. You're not here to return to God. You're here to do something much more gratifying. To come to believe in something that will enable you to live with God. Then you're going to show your gratitude by helping others? False. False. A lot of people have died thinking of that. You take actions and you help others, and eventually you get gratitude. Just the other way around. You take these actions, whatever your motives are. You take these actions, whatever you are thinking. That's why most of us in bad times have had sponsors who can point out what's a meaningful action and what's just BS. You little by little take actions, and you stay involved a little by little. The funny thing, here's an example. Tonight, I'm very glad I'm here. I'm really pleased to be here, see a lot of friends and new friends. But this morning I got up, I'd lost my credit cards, I didn't want to come here, I was hot, I didn't feel good, I called Bob Tobin this morning, said I lost my credit cards, I didn't even know if I can get there, for Christ's sake. It's just, I didn't feel like I was. I said, call me at 1 o'clock, I'll let you know if I'm coming. But I found my credit cards and quite cleverly had placed them at the bottom of a wastebasket. I blame somebody, I can't remember who, but it was their fault. My wife. Of course, I didn't even have that wastebasket there. Well, that's what Al-Anons are for, to gratify yourselves. But as my sponsor told me years ago, nobody asks you want to do it, you just do it. So, as I was grumbling and whining about how I didn't feel good, at the same time I was taking a shower and getting dressed and going to the airport, I thought, well, I'm not going to that goddamn old Auburn. And by the time I got here, I just felt grand and I feel good tonight and I feel glad to be here. But so many times in my life, I've had to go back to remember the great spiritual lessons I learned from my sponsor and other people. You know, they talk a lot about spirituality in AA. You think of prayer and you think of meditation. Let me tell you some great spiritual lessons. Do what you said you were going to do. Be where you said you were going to be when you said you would be there, or call them and let them know you're not coming. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Waiters, waitresses, employees, children. So easy to take out heat on that. Once upon a time, I was telling my sponsor, I'm just a full of rage, I can't stuff it, I just want to take it out. He said, over there's Mike Ross. He's 6'4", needs to be a pro football player. Go over and take it out of that son of a bitch. So, I discovered I could stuff it. But if you really must take it out on somebody you can answer back. Don't take it out on people who depend upon you for their stability. But now, these don't sound like spiritual tenets, do they? They sound like pragmatic. But that's all AA is. Love is not the answer here. Prayer is not the answer. Goodness is not the answer. The book expressly says all these things are fine, adjunctive things. But action is the magic word. You must change your actions. You know, the last few years have been a number of hospitals who say, we have a new thing, we call it behavioral modification, and we're helping people with various addictions. AA started that in 1939 with this book. Every therapy has always said, you come to us, we'll change your thinking, and eventually your actions will get better. AA says, you come to us, we will change your actions, and your thinking will get better, and you will be around to have your thinking get better.
Because you can't wait for your thinking to get better, because sometimes it just goes to hell again. Because you don't get sick like this. Boom! You get sick like this. Oh, it's terrible. I got it now. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, it's wrong. And that's why you got to remember, no matter how it sounds from the podium, you don't get well like this. I work 12 steps, it's wonderful. You get well like this. Oh, I'm on the right road. It's just, oh, son of a bitch. Oh, that's why we need each other. Some days I don't feel very good, and I surround myself with people who are doing good. Because next month, they won't be feeling very good, and they'll surround themselves with me who's feeling good. That's how it works. That's why they say stick with the winners. Who are the winners? It's not how long you've been sober. Those who are currently trying, they are the winners. The ones who are going to the meetings, the ones who are outgoing, the ones who are taking the actions, they're wondering, find out what they can do, and stay away from the people who are funding the ones what they can't do. Because AA is still the same as it was 54 years and 364 days ago, June 10th, 1935, when a failed stockbroker once again helped a drunken doctor, gave him a drink to steady his hand so he could do his surgery, cut a cancer out of a guy's colon, gave him a drink so he could do that, and he never drank again. What do? It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his terrible feelings of difference at least enough so that he'll begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And do you know what our job is tonight? For one alcoholic to talk to another alcoholic to help him reduce his terrible feelings of difference at least enough so that he'll begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And that's why we gather these things. That's why it's good to have a unity day, to remember with all the food and all the laughter and all the fun and all the drawings and all the prizes and all the meetings and all the speakers and all the laughter, this is the most deadly serious business you will ever have in your life. And you must remember that it isn't very hard to stay here. It doesn't take much of a man, but some days it takes all of you and other days it doesn't. But you hang in here. And you take actions, and you do the things, and you become part of things. This, you know, there's a great line at the end, in the long form of the traditions. You ought to read those two, because that makes the traditions come alive. In our group in Los Angeles, which is, I think, must be the largest group in the world now, 1,100 people get there every Wednesday night for a speaker meeting. But one night a month, one Wednesday a month, we read the long form of the traditions. Because it really explains how we can all live together and why we do these things. When you read the short form, it just goes so fast. The long form tells about it. But at the end of the long form of the traditions helps you understand, why do I keep doing these things? Why do I keep doing what AA says? Why do I take the actions I take? And the end of it is so clear. It says, this to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. And that's what we must do. So I'm very pleased tonight to be here. And just 2.5, 3.5 hours from now, I hope we'll all face towards Akron if we can find out where the hell that is. And just under my breath said, happy birthday. God bless you. Thank you. I'm glad to be alive. Thank you.